Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Low Blow Booking Podcast. My name is Derek Cornett, and we are coming at you live and in living color on your mobile listening devices, checking us out through iTunes and Podbean. We are growing by the day, and ladies and gentlemen, tonight is a very special night. I have got a very, very special guest. I want to welcome in a man who has traveled the world to do this great thing we call professional wrestling. This man is known throughout the nation as one of the tough enough competitors. He is currently with Lucha Underground. He is a man that came from Utah at UCW. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome in Martin Casals. Martin, how's it going tonight?
Man, after that freaking introduction, my night's going fantastic.
Absolutely. Martin, it's exciting to have you on the show. You and I met a couple years ago. Out in Utah when I came out and worked with Tyler Cintron, our mutual friend, and I'm thankful for the relationship that we have, and I'm looking forward to some of the things that we're going to be able to talk about here tonight and hopefully in the future, and get your perspective on some of the things that are going on in your career and some of the things that are going on now, and definitely what the future holds for Martin Casals in the world of professional wrestling.
I think it's an exciting time for professional wrestling and in my life right now, so that sounds like a good conversation for me.
Awesome. Well, you know, let's kick things back to when did you first become a wrestling fan? What was it that hooked you? Who were some of your early favorites? What were some of your earliest memories? Talk about what planted the seed for you to be where you're at this point in your life.
I came in, like, I hear all these stories, but hey, I watched it the entire time growing up, and I unfortunately didn't know about it until way later. The Monday Night Wars, right, in the middle of the heat of Monday Night Wars is when I first started taking note of professional wrestling. My grandpa used to watch WCW all the time, and I saw my first glimpses of wrestling when I saw the NWO kicking the crap out of somebody. Like, hey, that's not nice. So I was legit pissed at seeing this thing, these giant dudes beating the hell out of somebody on TV. And then I finally, like, the first match that I ever remember was in WCW Nitro, Bill Goldberg versus Hugh Morris in Salt Lake City. And I remember it because it was in Salt Lake City. Like, these guys travel. Oh, that's cool. So I started watching. And that's when I started getting hooked. And I was playing football. I was in high school back in that time. And, Goldberg, to me, popped out because I was playing football at that time. I was captain of the football team there, and Goldberg was this huge standout. So, hey, I would watch Goldberg tear it up to these guys.
Absolutely. I guess to give you a little insight, my first match that I remember seeing was Hulk Hogan versus Ted DiBiase in 1989 at a Saturday Night's Main Event. I've watched that tape. I watched that tape until it didn't get watched anymore. And then in about 2000, I got my hands on a video of that tape or of that show. And I've gone back and watched it numerous times. And it always brings back just fond memories of being a kid and having my wrestling guys sprawled out all over the place. And, you know, that's what really hooked me in. And that's what's brought me to this moment in my life. So who was the first one that kind of trained you in pro wrestling and how did you get started with it?
I went to one of the WWE shows here that was Lives of the Raw Roulette 1. They had an episode of Raw with some kind of Russian Roulette or Raw Roulette or something like that. That was the first time I ever went, and when I was standing in line to get in, one of the local guys here from the company handed me a flyer and said, hey, you should come check out this wrestling show we're doing. 2 months later, I looked in my room, and I finally found it again, went there with my best player from high school, and started training. I showed up, the second I stepped into the ring, the second I touched both feet on the ropes, I was like, this is cool. And so Steve Nelson, who is the owner of UCW, still 13 years right now, he was the first guy that gave me an introduction of kind of how wrestling is and what it's all about. And then Derek Jay was the man in the company and in the state. And so, like, you kind of gravitate towards him and try to learn as much from him as possible. So those two are the guys that I kind of pretty much say they trained me right from the beginning. And then way later, Tom Howard, a guy who ran UPW out in California, he actually came here, moved here for Utah, and he's been doing some training here, too. So he's a So I had a lot of different training from a lot of different people. But to start out, it was Derek Hubbard and Steve Nelson here at UCW.
Nice. I know that my training as a pro wrestler was pretty shady, if you will. $600, three sessions, ended up getting about six in, broke my leg midway through, and then was able to jump in the ring in 6 months. Not necessarily the best, if you will, but I think what helped me was that I had watched so much and I tried to study so much that I just was able to grasp it. How do you think that your training went, and how long was it for you to be able to step in the ring for the first time?
3 weeks.
Wow.
So I went in there for my first day, learned bumps, learned the introduction of wrestling, and a show 3 weeks later. And I'm not saying I knew anything about what I was doing, but I was lucky enough to become pretty much straight out of high school. I turned in my college. I had some college scholarships for football, wrestling, and lacrosse. But I wanted to focus on my studies, so I just kind of just gave up on athletics. But I still was a four-sport guy in high school, so I still had that very athletic about me, where I was, my head-eye coordination was all there, so I was able to pick up on the physical aspects of it pretty fast. And it was something that I was there in the ring training every single day, as many hours as I could, until they kicked me out and said, "I want to go home. Can we go home now?" Once you're in the ring, I just wanted to stay there. But yeah, it was really only 3 weeks. Was I ready? Not even freaking close. I had no clue what I was doing. And I watch it now, and it was god awful. But I wasn't gonna complain about it.
Absolutely. How do you think the mental and the psychological aspects of wrestling kind of focused into you? Where did you pick that up, or do you think that you've really grasped some of those things when it comes down to how much those really make a match in comparison to the athleticism?
Well, any sort of athletic person can do the physical things. And especially guys who've done the gymnastic things. You'll hear that a lot in like AAA wrestling. Like, hey, they can do some really cool stuff, but it makes zero sense. And then you got the WWE, which I hear a lot of people saying, well, hey, they pull some cool stuff out every once in a while. But mostly it's a bunch of entertainment. They're doing a lot more stuff rather than actual wrestling. So somewhere in the mix, and there's, if you have any sort of athletic background, you could pick up the moves pretty quickly. And this is something I didn't learn until way later. Like, I was doing all anything I could think of, throwing my body in the line, didn't care. But it's the reason why you're doing the moves and what you do between the moves that actually make the match. And I didn't learn that until far later, so until I started getting WWE experience, so I started traveling around. It just kind of snapped one day, like, oh, that's why I'm actually doing this. That's why I'm making an angry face here. That's why these people in the WWE are getting pops for making an angry face. And that's why they spend 6 minutes with 76,000 people going crazy because they're staring at each other. They don't need to hit a lockup the first 10 seconds of the match.
Absolutely. Now, you and I talked before we started going here tonight, and we're going to talk about WrestleMania in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you, if you watched the Undertaker-Bray Wyatt match?
I did.
And I thought that that was a clear example, excuse me, of two guys making facials at one another that really sold that contest as something a little bit more, because the Undertaker probably couldn't give everything he had, you know, but I thought that that was a match that had all that psychology in it. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. They're both, like, supernatural elements. And honestly, they hit all of the Undertaker, the old school, the Brave Boy, it is finishing move, there's tombstones. But there wasn't one that stuck out to me. But I do remember the moment where he's upside down in his little, like, spider or whatever the heck that's called, and then the Undertaker sits up, and I'm like, that's the moment when I popped to that the entire match. Like, oh, shit. Two different guys in the supernatural things looking face-to-face at each other in their different ways of putting over each of their characters. So I know it. I know how the match ended. But it's that one spot there where everyone popped when he sat up that's what got me more. So that's the thing I remember most about the match.
Absolutely. You spoke about characters. Your first gimmick, if you will, I guess, or your name that you went by was Tristan Gallo. Is that correct?
That's right.
How did you come up with this name? Is there a gimmick that went into Tristan Gallo that preceded you wrestling as Martin Casals?
Again, I started wrestling, and then I was in a match probably way too soon. I had no idea what the heck I was doing. But I had Steve Nelson, the owner of UCW, call me one day and said, "How does Tristan Gallo sound?" I'm like, "For what? For the name you're going to call you when you come out and wrestle." Oh, is that going to be my name? What's it mean? I don't know. It means something strong. Okay. He could have called me some sort of stupid, like, Pink Panther, and I would have been out there and wrestled the Pink Panther. Crap, I wanted to get the ring. So he literally just Googled up a name and gave me that. And really, the gimmick at first was I was just his little crony. So that was all right. I really didn't have any sort of gimmick except for the crony of him, who he plays the big evil owner of the corporation that you see pretty much in every single wrestling promotion ever.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm like, okay, I didn't think about gimmick because I was trying to figure out what the hell I was doing right on the court circle. But then I started figuring out, like, oh, okay, I should probably make myself stick out a little bit more than just the guy that comes out and kicks ass. So then I started thinking about, like, in my general life, I'm a little bit more, I think I watched too much cartoons when I was younger. My mom is honestly very animated in a cartoon. And so that's kind of how I am in life. I'm very friendly. I'm very touchy-feely. And so it comes off as flirting. My girlfriend said it's flirting, but it comes off as flirting. I'm just trying to be nice to everybody. And back at that time, I didn't have a girlfriend, so there was people that had their stipulations, what they thought I did with my nightlife. So I went with the ladies' band, half breed heartthrob, because I'm half Mexican and half white, but people can't tell because I don't have tan. So I went with half breed heartthrob, the reflection of perfection, best in sports entertainment. The men want to be and women want to be with. Pretty much anything relating to, hey, your girlfriend thinks I'm hot.
Yep.
That's what I was.
Now, have you watched any Gino Hernandez?
I didn't until I started working in NWA, and they started making comparisons.
Yep. Because that was, I mean, his was the handsome heartthrob, or the half-breed, and he played that thing to, you know, a perfect T, in my opinion. He's one of the all-time greats, and obviously there would be that natural comparison of somebody who's half Hispanic, half white, and taking that gimmick, and I was just wondering if that had anything to do with it, but after you saw somebody like that, is there anything that changed the way that you approached it, or no?
Yeah, I kind of went and saw a little bit of what he did. He almost had his lifestyle was really, like, we weren't doing a lot of backstage. Utah's kind of in this little, almost bubble. The closest wrestling place to us is 7 hours to Reno, or 8 hours to Las Vegas. Otherwise, you were working at this one promotion in Utah, so it was like this little bubble. So we weren't doing vignettes and backstage stuff where we're driving fancy cars. And I started watching Joe, and then I'm getting references like, hey, you remind me of this guy instantaneously. And I'm like, well, after doing research on him, that in my mind is a big compliment. Like, it needs to be more than just what you say on the mic. It needs to kind of portray a lifestyle, work the gimmick rather than just say you are this gimmick. So honestly, that's when I started wearing, I tried to wear a little bit more fancy clothes. When I was doing anything with wrestling, or if they were doing vignettes, I wanted it to be like in somewhere nicer as to put over, because everyone hates the people that are richer than them. That's just how it is.
So. Well, absolutely. And, you know, and that's what I think the character development aspects of gentlemen who and ladies who want to wrestle in the indies, we've got to take elements of other people into our gimmick. I know I was always a huge Stan Hansen fan, but God didn't grant me the gifts of being 6'5", 300 pounds, you know. But I still tried to incorporate that. Were there other guys that you were watching or that you had watched that you incorporated some of their aspects into your matches?
Very much. I thought originally when I first started, I was a big Goldberg fan. because I played football, he played football. And then I realized, when it comes down to wrestling, Goldberg's best part of it was his entrance. That about summed up the best part of his matches.
Yep.
But there was this dude, real smaller than everybody else, but he'll super kick people's faces and then grin real crappily, but the girls were going insane for him. They called themselves Shawn Michaels the Heartbreak Kid. And so, literally, that was the guy that I started like, okay, I was going to emulate myself after Goldberg, but now that I realize there's really nothing as much to emulate as there is with Shawn Michaels. So Shawn Michaels had the same believe you loved him gimmick. Very cocky, very snide, very sure of himself. But one thing that I took from him is that when it was time for him to put on heat, when he was a bad guy or when he was beating somebody up, you could tell he was having fun in the ring and with the people around him, winking at the girls and blowing kisses. He was having fun. And so that's what I actually took from him. And they always said, like, yeah, you just keep smiling the whole time here. And I'm like, yeah, I'm beating the hell out of some guy, and so it should be fun to me. And I'm getting a reaction out of this girl and that girl. I can do anything I want, and I get some sort of reaction out of these people. So that's what I kind of want to get out of him. It's just he was legit just having fun. And when you see somebody having fun, you can't help but have a little bit of the fun. It's just kind of contagious. When somebody smiles, you kind of want to smile back. I hate when people cry around me, because it's harder not to get emotional when you have people crying. Emotions are contagious, and I saw Shawn Michaels was having so much fun in there. I wanted to be in there having fun all the time, and the crowd was having fun because they were caffeinating off of him. So that's one thing that had Shawn Michaels that I just saw. He was so showmanship. He could do all this other stuff, but everything was in his facials and how he put together a match, and his fun was just contagious.
Yep. I know last night in the opening, LL Cool J actually did a pretty decent job, I thought, but he really put over how the fans are what makes the sport, and like you just said, that emotion. Last night there was one of the matches, I can't remember which one it was, but after the match they showed the fans, and like somebody turned behind themselves and just high-fived somebody, and it was like, that's what it's all about, dude. Just getting people, you know, last night 76,000 people all there to enjoy this event, and you're going to get a bevy of emotions, and when you get people to react in the same way or differently, but some people share it, I think that's what it's really all about. And like you said, emotion is contagious, and we want to give people a roller coaster ride when you're in the ring, and make them love you, hate you, everything. Now, you started out as a heel, I'm guessing, then with your boss there. Was there a moment in which you could make that turn to become a babyface?
There was, and it was really because of the fans. There wasn't, I did anything different, but I was just a heel, and I was just really, in my mind, and from the whole company standpoint, I was one of their strong heels, and I thoroughly enjoyed being the bad guy. But like I said, normally, I feel like I didn't realize I'm a pretty decent dude. I don't go out and randomly hit people or what, but that's a chance for me to be someone that I'm completely not, and hit on any single girl that I want to, make fun of any guy because he looked at me funny. I love being a heel. So I was a heel for a long time. But then I had some friends who started to just show up to some of the shows, like, oh, wow, this is really cool. So all of a sudden, it started becoming cool to cheer the bad guy. Well, that got more and more contagious. And in a wrestling crowd, you have one person that starts to chant, and the rest of however many thousands of people are starting to chant that same chant because this one person started. People are followers. They're like sheep, unfortunately. But fortunately, at the same time. So they started cheering me, and then all of a sudden now, whenever I start walking out, I'm getting cheered, but I'm over here telling you how much I had a good time with your girlfriend last night, and that you hate me, and you should be jealous of me, and yet you're cheering me. So we got really to the point where, well, guys, we're going to have to make the change. So it was the fans that made me turn into a good guy.
And it's a natural thing when that happens. It's not a booking decision. It's a natural ebb and flow of what you're doing, because in reality, they're just cheering your hard work and they're cheering the character that you're putting out there. And you put together something that they like, and then sometimes you catch lightning in a bottle and get to run with it. Was that kind of how things worked out for you? Was it a quick change, or was it slowly built? How did that work out?
It was, there was a couple guys that showed up that started to cheer me, and then it just got louder every show until 4 months in, we're like, okay, guys, you can't ignore it anymore. Like, I just kicked this guy in the nuts, got disqualified, but I got cheered. Like, that's not something normally you would cheer something for. I'm supposed to be a bad guy. But no, the fans just wanted to cheer me, and they give the fans what they want at the right time. you give the fans what they want, and it happened, I don't want to say fast, but it wasn't exactly slow either. But the fans just kept cheering, and so we eventually just, all right, we got to do this. And I agree with you 100%. The fans, you might catch lightning in a bottle. Since WWE Tough Enough, Stone Cold Steve Austin, he gave me his contact information. We've had multiple conversations, and he loves telling the story about how he just came one day. He said, Stone Cold 316, or Austin 316 said, I just whooped your ass. And then the next day, there's flyers, or giant posters of Austin 316. All of a sudden now, he has a whole new gimmick or a whole new attitude or a whole new something to work off that the fans literally just gave to him on a golden platter, and he ran with it. Now he's one of the best in WWE/wrestling history.
Yep.
All because the fans gave it to him on something that he just said out of his mouth. It was something like, hey, this Austin 316 is nothing really going to get over, I swear. So let me just say in this promo, then we'll totally change everything. Nah, he just said that just because he was a promo, and he just said it. He just had no intention. That is going to completely change his career. The fans, without the fans, there is no wrestling. You got to listen to the fans. The fans, again, sometimes fans make us all the stars either way. So sometimes they just give it to you amazingly. So Austin 316 is one hell of an example.
Absolutely. You know, that is really the example. And you look back at some of the real great heel face changes, and, you know, obviously the Hogan change comes to mind, even the Savage change back in 89. And, you know, some of these things are just great. Bret Hart's change, you know, his turn at WrestleMania with Steve Austin, it was, you know, that was magnetic because it really gave him some more life and helps you as a performer put together some different stuff in your repertoire. Did you notice that wrestling as a face compared to a heel changed some of the stuff that you did in terms of moves outside of just the emotional stuff that you were doing?
Very much so, because a lot of the stuff I was trying to be as blatant as possible to everybody but the referee that I'm cheating. Like, when I'm doing, I was wrestling. So now all of a sudden, I'm the guy that has to be the good guy. I'm the one that's supposed to be keeping the rules. That changed a lot of my rules there. And then so now I'm trying to. But at the same time, this whole time, I was trying every single move that I could see on TV or see on Nintendo 64, WCW Revenge, and No Mercy. Any sort of move that you went, I went out on my. Like, I was out there trying it just so I could say they did it. So I've done so many moves. Now I go back and watch the match, and I'm like, man, I totally forgot I did that move. Now I feel like in my match, I'm like, I don't do crap. I just smile a lot, and every once in a while I drop kick somebody's face off like that. It's just crazy to think about how move-oriented I was back in the day, trying all these different things and not having any sort of consistency with it whatsoever, versus now, where I don't even, like, okay, well, I think about moments in matches. Tom Howard talked to me about moments versus movesets. And I think that completely changed a lot of the way you put together matches. Especially for TV, because in TV shows, you never know what camera's going to catch that or who's going to look right at your face during this certain time. But TV, a lot of times, they can catch that, and when you watch it back and see that, like, oh my gosh, that guy's big thing in your face made this whole moment way better. So, yeah, I think it definitely changed that one for me. From a bad guy to a good guy, there, I don't know. Did you enjoy being a bad guy a lot more? I don't know if you can use heel or heel face terms or whatever.
Yeah.
Or how everybody should, but not you. Did you enjoy face, or did you like heel? But
I liked the natural flow that I got to do. I wore a shirt to the ring that said, "I'm better than you." And
there we go.
And it was a black shirt with a white lettering. And when it came down to it, it was a natural thing because I just went out there and worked my ass off. And I remember even when I turned babyface, it was natural. They just said, "All right, we're going to have you wrestle a heel tonight and see what you can do." And I walked out to the ring with a beer because somebody said, "Hey, you kind of look like James Storm." And I said, "Okay, well, let's see what happens. You know, he uses the beer gimmick right now. Let's just walk it out." Because in La Crosse, Wisconsin, everybody likes beer. So when I walked out there with it, man, people loved it. The girls loved it. You know, if you can get the girls cheering for you, everybody else is going to do it too. And, you know, it wasn't stone cold ask of like pouring beer all over my face. It was just walking out and cheersing people, you know, and then, you know, just talking shit in the ring and saying, "Hey, this is how it's going to be." I remember my favorite line was, "These people either love me or hate me, but they all respect me." And you just take that into the ring. And my turning point was a bull rope match in which I got my ass beaten and I ended up winning the whole, you know, I ended up getting my ass beat the entire, you know, 15 minutes of the match. And then I ended up winning. And it was against a much larger guy and ended up being the turning point for me. And that was my, you know, real big switch. And after that, you know, it just flew. And it was a great opportunity after that to just change up some of my move sets. And I still did some of the heel stuff, like doing the fish hook and things like that, you know, things that when you're wrestling somebody they don't like. But it worked out pretty well for me. I enjoyed both, primarily the heel, because you can just do so much more in terms of, you know, talking, rather than as a baby face where you're just kind of really trying to get the crowd into it.
Right.
But Ric Flair once said that Ricky Steamboat will never be the greatest wrestler of all time because he never worked heel. And he said, you've got to be able to do both in order to be the greatest. And I don't necessarily know if I agreed with it at the time, but as I've seen it more, I have to kind of slightly agree that you've got to be able to make the fans love you and hate you and then love you again, in order for it really to be as magnificent as possible. What would you say to that?
That's interesting. I actually kind of agree with that, and that's the way you put it there. And you changed my mind as you were saying it. So, yeah, he is, I think, one of the best, greatest wrestlers of all time. However, he was really good at making people love him. That's where it ended. And so Hulk Hogan made people love him, then hate him, then love him back again. So yeah, I actually kind of agree with you right there. I actually very much agree with that. But I'm not going to discredit him whatsoever, but damn, I actually kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I owe nothing against Ricky Steamboat by any means. I mean, in terms of, I always say you can't measure everybody on the same scale. In terms of a character, you know, that's a whole different thing. The Undertaker, in my opinion, is the greatest character in the history of professional wrestling. In terms of,
you think we're going to have this exact same conversation in 30 years with John Cena never trying to
play? Exactly. And then you look at work rate, a guy like Ricky Steamboat, a guy like Ric Flair, a guy like Shawn Michaels, those would be some of your top guys. If you look at promo work, you look at Roddy Piper, his promo was one of the best. And then, you know, but was he the greatest in-ring worker? Not so much. Was he the greatest character? Not so much. But did he have this other intangible that made him step up his game a little bit more? In terms of overall greatness, some of my favorites would definitely be CM Punk and Stone Cold Steve Austin. I thought that they took their game to the next level at times in which they needed to. And obviously, you look at guys like Hogan and Brett and Shawn, you know, they all did great things. But to me, those two are guys that are a lot alike, but they also stick out simply because that's kind of my attitude on a lot of things, too. They stuck up for what they believed in and really went out there to do the absolute best every single night.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think Macho Man is someone in the ring that can hold up with anybody, but at the same time, he had amazing promo work. Bret Hart, I think, was way better technically, coming from Stu, from the school there. But at the same time, I would rather watch him much more than Randy Savage or Bret Hart promo any day.
Yep.
So, and I, in my conversations with Steve Austin, he's like, oh, hey, well, I'm not going to say I'm a good in-ring worker at all, but hey, the fans like me. Well, that's kind of true, guys. When I'm looking at Shawn Michaels versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, I think Shawn Michaels can run circles just about around everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But Stone Cold Steve Austin is the icon. And I'm not sure. I don't know which one to put above each other, but Stone Cold Steve Austin can entertain people far by just holding the microphone and having a beer. And he's got people still. He's been out of rest for how long? I still heard the other day. I was like, yeah, just give me Steve Weiser. Like, okay.
It's one of those things that just doesn't die. And I just look back at some of those guys. And we talked about Gino Hernandez earlier. I read this quote by him one time. And it had to do with his wrestling career, because he died young. But he said that I've done more in professional wrestling at the age of like 21 or 25. It was some young number than most men will ever do in their entire careers. And, you know, live in the fast lane like that. And you look at a guy like that, you know, how high could the ceiling had been for him? And, you know, some of those missed opportunities. And that's what I think, you know, you try to capitalize on. And that's what I wanted to lead to our next question here. Now, the last time that we spoke, your role in UCW was more of a business partner. And were you doing anything creative with the company at that point?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what time we were talking last, because we've been talking for, we've been doing chat for a little bit longer now.
It was when your leg was broke is the last time that we got to meet one another.
Oh, wow, yeah, okay. Yes, that's 2011. Was that 5 years now? So
yeah.
So I'm 6 years now. So after that, my main focus after I break my leg was get back to the ring as fast as possible. And after I did that, I kind of went into some backstage stuff, where I started doing a little bit more of the booking and just running more practices and taking care of the day-to-day stuff rather than just showing up doing my magic now. So
that's why I'm here today is I love booking. I love the creative aspects. I think, you know, in our conversations, especially, and we're going to talk about Paul here in a second, but that's what brought me and him together. It was my mind for, I love the WWE. I love the product, but I also love trying to make it better in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And that's why I have the Low Blow Booking Podcast. We go back and we look at shows and change things up for hopefully the better. But that's really what drives me in this realm of wrestling. Were there opportunities that you got to take in creative, where you were able to do some of those things?
Yeah, and because here, the reason I became part of it is twofold. One, when I was getting to the show every day, I saw a match and I'm like, well, why am I wrestling this guy? Well, why am I wrestling that guy? It didn't really make any sense. And now it got to the point where I was coming back from Tough Enough, and they took me out of that show in a very good light. So whoever edited that, I've met you before, but thank you very much, because you made me look like a superhero. But you take me out of that show looking like a superhero, so you're not going to make me a bad guy right off the bat. So I was a good guy, and then we needed a bad guy, so they made me a bad guy, and somebody else stepped up, and then so, like, 2 months later, I was a good guy again. I'm like, I see needing business switches, but this is getting to the point where I'm confused whether I'm good or bad, so the fans are going to be all sorts of confused. So this needs to change. Plus, with me, and I don't know if this is you too, but most wrestlers, this is what it's like. You're your worst critic. So what I like to do is every single time I have a match, I like to find a way to get it recorded so that on the drive home or when I get home that night, I can record, like, I didn't like this, I didn't like that, I could have done this a little bit different. And what I set up at UCW was there was really not a great way to do that. There was a couple cameras here, so I went out and researched and made basically our audio and video production department. I created it, so now we got back like live editing and stuff, so I have an edited product by the time I get back home from the show. And I just went and like just spent my money and learned and trying to figure out this RC Willie duct tape piece of audio and video equipment stuff that made that happen so I could do that. And that's when I got backstage, so that is, I set up that audio and video equipment so I could critique myself, and then I started getting into booking. And by that time I had done some TV stuff, so I had a little bit more experience, and so now I'm teaching guys about, hey, work the hard cam, stuff like that. When you first start wrestling, depending on where you're at, and there's no TV, there may not be hard cam that you need to work.
Yep.
But just learning, and you know too, learning this stuff in the back, and I'm like, okay, now I understand, like, yeah, it's just a whole new respect for the guys that don't get enough credit in my mind, because superstars get all sorts of fame and accolades, but the guys that set up the ring every single day in the WWE, the guys that do the editing, the guys that do the music, the guys that do all, they don't get enough credit for sure, because without them, there's not a wrestling show either.
Yeah. I think, like you just said, when you go and you look at the booking sheet and you say, why am I wrestling this guy? What's the story? I got in so much trouble. Every time I'd get to an arena, and I would try to do it beforehand, and I'd try to talk to the guy and say, you know, who am I wrestling and what's the story, like we just said. And, you know, I remember one time I had a really hard sell because I just turned, and they wanted me to lose to another babyface. I was like, you guys are missing an opportunity here. And, you know, I had to play the politics game and say, we're going to have a good match, but you're going to kill my character. You can't have me, you know, christen this new character, turn babyface, and then get my ass whooped every week. It's not going to work. And, you know, and luckily they were able to see some of my side of the story. Perhaps I was hard to work with at times, but I felt so, you know, important on this is what you have to do in order to make these things work. And I always thought that my creativeness in wrestling and in gimmicks and in stories was always a lot better than some. And I just never had the capital to say, all right, well, I'm going to run my own wrestling promotion and do that, you know, because that costs a lot of money.
It does. Yeah. And honestly, if you still be shut down, I don't think I ever was. I like the being in the ring far more than the day-to-day stuff. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. And I think that's my aspect is I ended up breaking my back when I wrestled. I broke my L6. And just taking bumps. It could have been anything. But I never knew about it because the muscles had grown over the fracture. So I just would wake up in excruciating pain. You know those roll things that you can roll your back on that athletic trainers have? Yeah, that and I used it at your house. When I came out there, Paul had one. I said, dude, can I use this? And he's like, oh, absolutely. And I could just feel my back and all the tension just leaving it. I finally went to the chiropractor and said, dude, your back's broken. And they said, do you know how long it's been broken? I'm guessing at some point over the last 10 years it happened because I hadn't had any back trauma since I quit wrestling. And, you know, that was something, you know, that putting your body on the line and giving up, you know, indie wrestlers don't have health care, I know that my injuries in wrestling, I had two broken orbital bones in my face. I had my eye socket broken twice. I broke both of my legs once. And then, of course, my back. And I still enjoyed it. But what it came down to is I really liked that backstage aspect of it. I liked putting together a story so that people could really get hooked into it, and I've always looked for an opportunity to do that, and that really led me to getting to know our mutual friend, Paul Grosskreutz, a.k.a. Tyler Cintron. The first time I met Paul, I was dressed up for Halloween, and I was Paris Hilton when she was in prison. I had the prison jumpsuit, I had the blonde wig, the glasses, the purse, and the dog, and he was, of course, dressed as John Cena. And
that was really.
Yeah. We imagine Paul being dressed as John Cena. But we struck it from there, and we've been friends, you know, now for almost 8 years, and talked pretty consistently in that time. What was it like when you met him, and what did you see in him? Where did that relationship start, and where has it gone since then?
Well, and then honestly, by the time he started, I was doing a little bit more traveling, so I wasn't at the day-to-day practices as much. I hit my 4 hours in the ring when I was in town, and I'd be hitting the next show in another town, so I didn't get to be part of the actual kind of switch on getting trained. But then I'd get back, and I'd check in with certain people, like, hey, so how's it going here, and I just kept hearing about this kid. He's like, yeah, this guy, he's catching on really quick. He's charismatic as hell. And I think you know, he's going to be the show here pretty quick. I'm like, all right, cool. That sounds awesome. And then I met him. And he's obviously, you know, he's a great guy. So, and he just happens to be one of, like, I don't want to say a prodigy, because then he'll get a big head about it.
Yeah, he's already got a big enough head. Let's be serious.
Yeah, he's got a big enough head. But he was one of those guys that just had something different when they came in to wrestling, because he hasn't been in the business 10 years or anything like that, like some of us old folks are. But he was in the business for a short time, and by that time, he'd been traveling more than some of the guys that had been in the business a little bit longer and just didn't want it as much as he did, or didn't feel... It takes a certain level of confidence, I think, to go to a completely different state, drive 12 hours, go to a completely different state, go into a locker room where everyone does the same thing, but you're the outsider, and go shake every single person's hand in the locker room and figure out a match, whoever you're going to wrestle. It takes a certain kind of outgoing charisma. It takes a certain set of balls, I think, as well. You can't be an introvert very well and be a very good professional wrestler that gets out there.
I have a quick question. The wrestler handshake, do you do it?
I do it, but I do it.
Oh, man. I started messing with people as I started wrestling more and getting pretty good at things. I was pretty snug, and I always had people come up and say, "Man, you guys really hit each other." I said, "Yep, we do." And I remember going to these shows in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and people I didn't know, and I'd shake their hand really hard and just smile at them. I was always a jerk about it, but then I tell them I'm not like that. You know, I just want to shake your hand and let you know I'm a good guy, and I always thought it was funny. I always thought that was good.
I did too. And in my mind, I am a stockbroker besides my what I do in the wrestling. So in business, you shake your hand like man, you shake like, hey, I'm here, I'm doing here in your business. I was a wrestler in high school, so I had a really strong hand. So I tried to make a point of it, squeezing the shit out of their hands a little bit. Sorry if I'm swearing my confidence. But shaking their hands pretty hard. So they know, like, okay, this guy, it puts a first impression into you. The second you see somebody, you automatically form an opinion. First thing that comes out of their mouth, you form an opinion. And the first time you touch them in any sort of way, you form a different opinion. So between the three senses there, I wanted to make sure that handshake was tough as hell. But then I figured out the wrestling handshake, and I hate it with a passion. But I didn't know enough in the business to know if I go in there shake hands that I wouldn't be able to recover from the heat that, you know, I think I just disrespectful that I had a night. So I hate it, but until someone like the Undertaker or someone like that tells me anything different that has been in the older school now,
yeah,
I'm probably not going to change it.
And for those of you that don't know, if you have a firm handshake in the world of at least indie pro wrestling, that means that you are a stiff worker. If you have a limp handshake, that means that you are, you know, you're not going to hurt anybody. And I think that you and I can both agree it's probably one of the more frowned upon things in our opinion. But and I remember watching Hacksaw Jim Duggan say one day he just badmouthed the shit out of it. It was hilarious. But you know, it's one of those things, and you know, you have to conform to stuff sometime. And so again, let's get back to Paul here. And, you know, his character of Tyler Cintron, him and I worked a little bit on some of the stuff that became that, and he obviously took it and ran. How were your first matches with him when you got the opportunity to work with him?
They've always... Here's the thing that bugs me, is me and him have always had good matches. But I know the level of match that I can put on. I've put on good matches in my career. I've seen him put on 5-star matches. I don't think in my mind, because I know what he can do, I know what I can do, that we've had the match both of us have been looking for out of each other. We've had good matches from what we watched, but I don't think that me and him, at least in my mind, and he may think we had a great match, I don't know. But in my mind, I don't think me and him have pulled the match that we want out of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy, because I've been in the business for a little bit. He's damn good at what he's doing. And there's no reason to not have a stellar match. But I do not know, like, we've had good ones, but I know there's this one match that's going to be, that was my favorite, and it hasn't happened yet. Tyler Cintron, in case you're listening to this podcast, I know we're friends, but one of these times we should just go to blows. Just so they're out there. In my mind, I know we can do better. We've had good matches, but I know we can do better.
I think that's what we all strive for, too. I know that my best matches were against a guy that I was a tag team partner with, Devlin Kane. And, I mean, we'd go out there and beat the living piss out of each other. And we knew that we weren't going to hurt each other. The closest that I came was we were having that bull rope match, and I made a shiv, and I put it in my boot, and I pulled it out, and I came really damn close to poking his eye out. But he gave me a nice receipt when he hit me in the face with the cowbell. And no, ladies and gentlemen, I don't put my hand up in the air, you know, to stop that thing. That cowbell hit me right in the fucking mush.
I hate that.
But that's what it is, man. You go out there and you feel protected by that guy, and that's what you do. You build that relationship with him, and that's why, you know, things work out and you end up having great matches with those people. But you're always wanting that better one, and I don't know where, if I will ever get a chance to wrestle again, but that's definitely what I'd like. I've always wanted to wrestle against Tyler. I did get to wrestle with him. We got to do a tag team match, and that was fun. I still don't think it was my best match due to this, that, or the other. But the first time he got into a ring, I took him to Black River Falls, Wisconsin, and we were wrestling, and they didn't put a real tarp down for the mat, and I ended up breaking my leg. And I still wanted to get in there because I broke it. Like, we had probably 3 hours of training. I broke it at, like, the second hour, iced it up, and still tried to get back in there and wrestle, and it just wasn't working. But yeah, exactly. So let's talk about that feeling. Tough Enough. WWE brought it back. They were going to give it a spot on the USA Network. They were bringing in Stone Cold Steve Austin to be the man. Now, they put out the casting call. And I don't know if you can divulge all the information, but did you have to go through that same process, or were you somebody on a short list that was contacted before that?
I had to still go through that process. Yes, I was still on a list, because what happened was I got contacted via Facebook. No joke. So I see all these guys around me, like, hey, I got to put my profile and video on this site, and then I ask people to vote. I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that. I just think that's weird to have people vote for me to be on a television show, especially with the aura around reality TV that it's all fake anyway. But I was on this list. I had contacted on Facebook. Some guys like, hey, I'm plus such and such. You're on a list from the WWE of people that we should be contacting to let you know that you should probably submit your information. They were just like, just give it a shot. And then so I sat there for like 3 days. I tried to write it. Didn't write them back. So I'm like, trying to punk me or something. Like, someone's just like messing with my head. Then I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, wait a minute. If you get a Facebook message and it really is somebody from a production company or something, and I don't reply, and I don't go, and I always wonder what if, that would suck.
Oh, absolutely.
So, hey, you know, yeah, right? It would suck. And, it was actually somebody with me being on a list from WWE, people who done stuff with the WWE. I did extra work by the time I had a tryout in 2007, back with FCW. So I'd done stuff with the WWE, knew who I was, but it's still random to get a Facebook message and not say, hey, go to the site and make people vote for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I made a video, and I did a couple of interviews, and I sent it to them all, and it's like, yeah, hey, well, they really liked your interview that I had with you, so I want you to send in a video just kind of highlighting who you are. So I sent that in, and it was like, it was a several-week process to finally get a phone call saying, hey, yeah, no, you're doing really good. Actually, we're taking we're gonna make a couple more decisions, and we might bring you down to California for a week to see if we can nail it down to the final 14. I'm like, holy crap. Yeah, so I had to go through that whole process. And I guess there's like 100-something people, because I went down to the hotel for a week, and they narrowed it down, and the rest is history, I guess, because you saw me on TV.
Yeah, let's talk about that history. So you get the call or the talk to be able to do this. What are those first days like where you meet the other cast members, you kind of relocate yourself, you can't tell anybody anything, even though, long story short, Paul Grossgrides, Tyler Cintron, you little son of a bitch, you let me know. So I was definitely checking it out to see what was going on. What was that like, man? I mean, you're getting an opportunity that, 14 people, right? Is that how many there were?
That's right.
Yeah. So you've got a chance of one in, you know, a million almost when it comes down to it of people that get a chance to do this, and you get to work with Stone Cold. What was those first days like? I mean, Cloud Nine, honeymooning, what was it like for you?
I really don't think it was surreal that entire time what was going on until months after the surgery and everything was over. We stayed down there for a week when they were narrowing it down to the final 14. You literally couldn't leave your room. They wouldn't even give you a key. Somebody walked you up, let you in your room. If you left your room, you're screwed. Like, they didn't want people screwing around. So you're stuck in your room. So finally, the girl comes up to us with a camera and says, hey, you made the top 14. And so I'm ecstatic. So then I finally get in the bus, and you sit and look at 13 other people. Well, 12, because they didn't have Miss USA there until later. They had 12 other people driving us to the mansion, but they said, you can't talk to each other. I know this is your competition, and that's what it was. I'm like, this is the guy that I have to out-wrestle. But you can't talk to each other because the cameras aren't on while we're in the bus. So you can't talk to each other. And, of course, we tried as much as we could to not get caught, but we tried as much as we could to talk to. But it's surreal, because now I'm like, is this really happening? Because I'm in a bus, and there's tons of people that I don't know. I'm in California, and we're driving to a giant mansion. Okay, so then we finally get there. No, I think the first time we went was Raw, and I've done extra work plenty of times at Raw. But they walk us through, and I've never walked down the ramp. And so this is the first time being, so I've been in gorilla position before, which for those fans who don't know, that's right before you go out that curtain, you're out there in front of the millions of people watching WWE Raw. I've been on that side of the curtain, just feet from it, but I've never actually walked myself through that curtain and walked down the ramp. So finally, we're all there, they have us walk through there, so now all of a sudden I'm geeking out like a 10-year-old kid. And then I look down the ramp, they have us walk down the ramp, and you got Stone Cold Steve Austin there in the middle of the ring and basically introducing himself to you. And the whole time I'm thinking, like, this really isn't happening. Don't do anything stupid. Just think, one foot in front of each other. Don't fall on your face in front of everybody. It was surreal. The whole thing was surreal. Like, that's how the first thing is. My first time walking down the ramp. I've been around hundreds of times before that. It was my first time walking on the ramp. Then my first time meeting Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then they had Pyro going. It was crazy. And then they started immediately whooping the shit out of us. I'm sorry, I keep swearing. But they had us doing a bunch of work back there during the Raw while it was happening. And it was weird because you're trying to talk to each other now. It finally, once the camera started, you got to work. Now you're sitting there trying to talk to as many people as possible, trying to figure out who these people were. What does my competition look like? Because you have no idea who these people are. And so I see, I finally figured out, I had like, Ariana was a girl who never wrestled a day in her life. That's after somebody else named Matt Cross, who's been in 14 different countries by the time we're here. I'm like, all right, buddy, I have all sorts of competition here. It's, the whole thing was surreal. Just think about it. The way I think I put it out to people is people go out, get the PlayStation 4s, they get WWE 2K, whatever, and then they have that mode where you walk around backstage and you bump into John Cena, you bump into this guy, you bump into that guy. That's what it was like to me, because I've been there a million times, but I never met Stone Cold. I never walked down the ramp. And now I have a camera following me. But at the same time, it's a competition mode. So I have to figure out who the heck these guys are and who's going to be my main competition.
Mm-hmm.
It was surreal, and I just had to keep thinking, this is a competition. You're not Stone Cold Steve Austin. You're my trainer.
Yep.
So long story short, surreal, crazy, but I had to just keep thinking, this is a competition. If you want us to end, start marking out and be crazy.
And I was actually going to tell you, I think that what what's the right way I'm going to say this? And I don't mean it to be rude if it comes out that way, but your lack of marksmanship, if you will, is what allowed you to be so successful on that show. And even when, because I didn't know you at that time, and Paul and I were talking and about, you know, your chances and stuff like that, and I think that, you know, after watching it, it's like you didn't let yourself get caught in the moment of, you know, kind of like, even I say that I try not to, but shit, Stone Cold Steve Austin's in front of me, I'm going to, you know, get a little giddy. But the fact that you were there to do work and, you know, make the most of this opportunity, I think that's what brought you to that next level and going through the competitions and being, I mean, you were the front runner. And then it kind of came crashing down. So let's talk about the process up until the break and what were your experiences like with the group, with the trainers, and was it something that you'll always be able to look back on? Is there anything that you would like to change?
Honestly, I would wish I was a little bit more outgoing and kind of living by the moment, and almost, because I kind of, in order to do that, where, okay, I'm not talking to Stone Cold Steve Austin, I'm talking to a trainer. I'm not talking to Chris Stratus, I'm talking to a trainer. I'm not talking to Bill. In my mind, okay, this is my high school wrestling coach.
Yep.
So, you gotta listen to him, he knows what he's doing. And so that's kind of how I went about it, and there was very few times when I was sitting in that mansion where I took a step out of myself and, dude, you're in a multi-million-dollar mansion. Everything that you do is being watched right now by going to be millions of people. Stone Cold Steve Austin is asleep right now waiting for him. Gonna be waking up, and you're gonna talk to him first thing in the morning. And, hey, literally, I could ask for anything right now, and they give it to you. Cause, like, hey, I need energy drinks. They filled us full of energy drinks. Like, there was very few times where I sat out of myself and just took in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the one thing that I was changing, because I was just thinking about winning the competition and what would be better for me, and very little time to actually sit and enjoy the whole process. I think the one time that I finally just let it go was when I won the third competition in a row. Luke Robinson was all sorts of pissed off because now everyone's like, oh, you're the man, and then all of a sudden they're looking at me a little bit. So he's all pissed off, which honestly made me feel kind of good.
Mm-hmm.
Then Stone Cold Steve Austin asked, hey, isn't this like your third time living? I'm like, yeah, it's my third. Well, good job. He just shakes my hand in front of everybody. I'm like, all right, I'm feeling pretty freaking good right now.
Yep.
So that was the only time I was able to step out. I'm like, I feel fantastic right now. And you can actually see me legit smile on that interview and just be excited about where my position at that spot. But that'd be the one thing I would take away. And we, as wrestlers, we keep thinking about what's going to be the next thing. How can I be better? We don't actually, in my mind, just let it sink in.
Well, I think that's the thing, too. I mean, when you're in that position, you're always trying to, and like we talked about, you're your biggest critic. What can I do to be better? I mean, there is no okay. You have to be better at every point in time, and you prove that on the show. I mean, you put yourself ahead of everybody, and then you had this event. Walk us through how your leg was broke, the circumstances, what it came down to, and what you're going like physically and mentally.
Well, so what happened is what we normally did, and it was a complete mind game this whole time, because they didn't say, okay, tomorrow at 10 o'clock we're going to go to training. They just had one PA guy, or personal assistant guy, come down and say, okay, you guys ready? Let's go. And if you weren't down in the kitchen at that time, you're up in the restroom or you're upstairs reading, you'd miss out, and that'd be great TV, because then you'd get yelled at and be blamed for being late. They never gave you a time. So it was a mind screw. Like, okay, I think I'll be around here, even though it's 6 o'clock in the morning, because you never know if they're going to show up at 7 to say go to training, or at noon to say go to training. So it was a big mind screw, just kind of waiting for the day to start. And then we had our 2-3-4-hour training, whatever it was. I think it's 3-3.5-hour training. We had a training. We took a break, and then went back and did it. But then what happened was, is they said, okay, well, you guys all had a pretty rough day. Like, people were just screwing up. They were forgetting the spots. They were hitting. It was just, you know, sometimes you have off days. And so, all right, we're going to have a night training. Crap. And these weren't easy, like, smile at this angle for this camp. These were like, they kicked the crap out of you. So when they said, hey, we had a bad day, so we're going to do it again tonight. Everyone's mood was just kind of down. And then we went into our night training. We went there, and literally we were just doing the drills, and everyone was doing a lot better than they were before. The mood's going up. And then we did a pin drill. Literally one guy lays down there, and there's a line behind. You jump on, you pin him, he kicks out, and the next guy goes. You pin him, he kicks out, you roll out, and you get back to the line. Like, it's not a hard drill at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not physically demanding drill. You can do that day one of training. But I was the one that I jumped on top of Andy Levine. I pinned him. He kicked out. I walked towards the rope so I could get out of the ring. And then I felt this cock and a giant sting in my leg. So I rolled out, got back in line. And I didn't know what it was. I think, okay, maybe I just twisted it or something. I'll just have somebody tape it up tomorrow. I went in there, and we did, like, 2 more drills. And every time I started walking in there, I was doing the drills, but all of a sudden now I put my pressure on one leg, and now I can't do that anymore. So now I'm hopping out on one leg doing these drills. And then finally it got to the point where a lot of more people were screwing up, and they had to sit down and build them on. I had a giant yell at you session where he said, basically, do you know what kind of opportunity you guys have? And it was a great speech. And like everybody, like, yeah, this is a great opportunity. But the whole time I'm rubbing my ankle, like, this is good. Then we go do it in the training case. So what they didn't show this whole time, we didn't talk enough. I'm sorry, I go off on stories about this because this is martial shit.
That's what people want to hear, man. Everybody that talked to me, they said, talk about tough enough. And then we're going to get to the other big one here in a couple minutes.
Yeah. No, I go off on this because people, they didn't show this at all. They showed me walk away and it doesn't snap and you see me roll out, and then it shows to like an hour and a half later. But I actually went in there, hopped in, and did like 2 more drills. Then we got yelled at for about 10 minutes. Then we went back in and did the drill. I rolled out, and then Bill started coming over and talked to me, and that's where it cut to. It cut out the part where I tried 2 more times. Then it cut out the part where me and Bill had a little bit of a riff going back and forth. He's like, you all right? Yeah, man, I'm fine. Don't try and be a hero here. There's no heroes here. Like, no, I'm fine. Stand on both feet. Can you stand up on both feet? And I stood up, and he's like, well, actually, stand on one foot. I couldn't stand up on one foot. He's like, sit down. Get the chain to look at you right now. So I'm swearing because I know for a fact they send me to the doctors. I don't know what's wrong with it. I don't want to have them have any sort of excuse to send me home.
Yep.
And that's when this TV started showing up. That's when it started showing up. Me, I'm like talking with Bill. I'm talking with Steve. He's Yeah, that's what happens. He's like, I don't know. I'm like, I don't know. So the trainer takes it off. It's really popped up real big. And I'm like, I'm fine. Just give me some ibuprofen. Let's wrap it up. Let's go. He's like, no, I really think if your kid's dead on 1 foot, that you should go to the hospital real quick to get a quick x-ray. But I really, and I told him word for word, I really do not want to do that because if something's wrong with it, you guys aren't going to let me do this again. Well, no. Well, if you say there's nothing wrong, then we don't have to worry about it. There's nothing wrong with it. I highly, highly suggest that you go to the hospital right now. And then Bill's like, if you see a suggestion, I should say you do it. Like, go. I don't want to look bad and leave this practice when we're 80% through it. That's going to look bad at me in the competition, and I don't want to leave and look bad in this competition. Like, no. You know what? If you're not going to get back in the ring today, I want you to go to the hospital right now. So I swear a little bit, and then I say, okay, I'm going. But I get in the van, and I put my hand on my face, and I'm like, this is bad. And then I make the girl promise me, like, hey, if they say something's wrong with it, I want you to wrap it up so I can't feel it, and you let me continue on. I said, sure, because then they should apply to me, because they knew they can't do it for insurance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I didn't want to go. Anyway, they sent me away, and I'm scared crapless about my position. I'm doing really great. I went 3 in a row, and they just sent me home early for a practice. That's not good. I go, and they x-ray it, and then they tell me it's broken, and that they can't let me do it anymore. I can't wrestle anymore. I'm out of the competition. I'm like, no. And so one of the producers was with me, and I said, I want a second opinion. And then by the time I got to my fourth opinion, because everyone kept saying the same damn thing, there just said, there's no more doctors left. Every single doctor here in this hospital says you can't wrestle anymore. There's no one left to give you a second or fifth opinion now. And so I'm really glad the cameras were back there, because I don't think I cried like that since I was like 10, or okay, 10, maybe like 2.
I was, don't lie, 18. It was 17.
There we go. Okay, maybe it was yesterday. but no, they finally said, like, hey, you're out of the competition, so we'll have you go tomorrow. We'll talk to the guys, we'll let them know you're out of the competition. And so that's when I lost it. Like, no more. I asked them work straight up, just, can you just shoot it up with something so I can feel it? Give me a week and I win this competition. And there wasn't that many more people left, so like, give me a little bit of time to shoot it up, so they wrap it up.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of people working with like this, like for insurance reasons, they can't let you continue. And we do that. If we shoot you back up, you're not going to be able to walk anymore. I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, well, I've heard of wrestlers, like, they're all messed up, and they go out there and still do their job. They still put on a good show. Is it smart? No, but maybe it'll heal. I don't know. But they finally told me that, and that was like four and a half hours in the hospital. And then the producer, Eric Van Wagen, came and just said, dude, that sucks so bad. And I'm sorry. And then so they took me to a hotel that night and didn't let me see anybody. And then I just had to sit in that hotel room and just think about it all being over. So that sucked. And then something else happened that night. I'm not going to go into that, but it was a great time.
yeah, I can only imagine.
Something else happened that night. I was able to hang out with some friends, but I didn't know we were still there. And then I ended up going that morning to go. I was just going to tell everybody, okay, like, hey, guys, you can, like, gather my stuff. But I get to there in front of everyone, like, we pull out to the like training facility, and then he's like, okay, so you're gonna go in there, and then you're going to tell everybody on camera that what the doctor told you. I'm like, wait, so I'm gonna be on? I thought I was just gonna go like tell them and what, but they're like, no, you're gonna be on TV in like 2 minutes. So I've been kind of up all night, not able to sleep, and so I look like hell. And then I like clutched my butt into there, and I had to give an announcement. And then I was the legit emotional because, like, I didn't know I was literally going to go in there and say goodbye to everybody right at that time on TV in front of everybody. Adios to Steve Austin, have this giant thing where he lets me hang up my own belt and then leave and never go back to his compound. I thought it was going to be like, I go in there, say goodbye to everybody, and then we can go on TV. No, it's just, I get there, and, hey, you're coming on TV in 2 minutes, this is what you can do. I'm like, whoa, okay, I've been up all night, I haven't slept, and you're about to be throwing me through some emotional bullcrap that I don't know if I can understand right now.
Yep.
So that's what I did.
And I think that, you know, many would say that was probably the most emotional moment of the show, kind of a defining moment, you know, to take a favorite out and not allow you the opportunity to do what you were there to do. And then it was rehab time. And so how much was your phone just ringing off the hook? How many offers were you getting after everything happened? When it finally aired, you had to leave. You were back at home. You know, you got your foot in a boot. What was life like after that?
Well, we hadn't been able to get to our phones pretty much the whole time we're there. So, and they wouldn't allow us to tell people when we're going to the hotel the very first part. Hey, we're gonna go down there possibly be on WWE stuff. So I lied to everybody that I was helping the brokerage firm opening up a stockbroker firm in California, and so everyone's just like, man, you're just like not answering my phone calls, where you at? So no one knew, except for just a very, very, very select few people.
I was one of them.
So all of a sudden I get my phone and I have all those messages, and then I guess while I was there, like promos and commercials started coming out to see people like zooming in to see who made the cut. So that's why I didn't post on there. And then it finally gets to the point where it was like WrestleMania was 3 weeks after that.
Yeah, because you got to go to WrestleMania, correct?
Yeah, we went to WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And then we got introduced at WrestleMania. Introduced the day after Raw, and that day after Raw, WrestleMania, that's when WWE Tough Enough started.
Yep, that's I remember that, yep.
And I was, and we were filming, it was just a couple weeks before that, where I got injured, before we got done filming, and it was like a week after that was WrestleMania. So it wasn't that much time, so I had actually had surgery for my foot, or I was about to have surgery for my foot, like the day before or the day, like a week. It was like, I was going to have my surgery the next day or something like that. Or I just had it. I can't remember, but it was like, you shouldn't be walking on this. And in my mind, I went there and like, okay, we're going to introduce you to the world. You're going to walk out there with WWE Raw. Cool. So I went out there and we did the rehearsals. So I was like, yeah, guys, get to where they want to be. And I'm on my crutches. And then like, well, we can't let them know you're hurt, so you're going to have to do it without your crutches. Do you have another shoe? I have my other shoe. I haven't walked on it without my crutches, literally just before it's been hurt. But go ahead and try it. I'm like, okay, so I had to do the rehearsals, and you can see, like, this line. We all walk down in the line, and you can see, like, me just getting further and further back, because I can't keep up with walking down that ramp with a broken foot.
Yep.
So finally, rehearsals, they threw me in the very back. Said, okay, we'll do that. But hey, to finally pull me in the bathroom with the trainers and say, is it okay? Like, they have to grab it or give some pain pills or something. Like, there's something so I can do tonight. Like, well, hey, I just wanted to bring it up to you that if you don't want to walk out there tonight, then you don't have to, because I don't want you getting hurt or anything like that. And so, in my mind, I had the opportunity to walk out in WWE Monday Night Raw, walk down the ramp for the second time in my career. This one just happens to be while the cameras are rolling live internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying I don't have to do it, but it's my choice.
Yep.
You're like, yeah, you don't have to do it. No, you're going to wrap this thing up. You're going to give me crazy little pain pills so I can't feel this. Now I'm going to stumble my way out there and make sure I walk out of Monday Night Raw tonight. So, and it was awesome because I walked back there, and then I'm walking with my crutches all the way up to gorilla position, and I hand it over to them, like, sure you want to do it? I'm like, hell yeah. So I walk out there, and I grit my teeth the entire time. pain while they're walking because it hurts like a mother trucker. And I had a spot over here as a proponent of pain pills. I know people who abuse those, but I just need to get past that one walkthrough. But I'm screening my teeth like a mother trucker, but I'm at the same time, that was one of the moments where I was just concentrating so hard on walking and not falling over and making a scene that I wish that I could have sat back and gone out of myself and just thought about, you're walking out on Monday Night Raw live. That was one of the moments that, like, I really wish I was there. But I was concentrating on walking and not falling over.
Yeah, like I said, when I broke my leg, I had that same walk to my finals. I don't think it was the same emotional output that you had, but definitely what an experience. I mean, just, you know, to sit here and listen to it firsthand, you know, the fan and the competitor and the love for the industry, it's just like, man, I'd give anything for that moment and that opportunity that you had and what you could do from it. That's just a great thing. And, it's awesome that you got to experience it. I'm excited because now people get to hear your side of the story to it. One thing that is stemmed from Tough Enough was, Bill DeMott being a trainer down, with NXT and the Performance Center, in, you know, his subsequent firing due to his behavior. And like you just talked about, there were some times when he was yelling. Do you care to share anything on your side of that whole situation of you being somebody that was trained by him? Was it really as bad as people made it out to be?
Here's the thing that I've been trying to figure out. I was going to go say something, but I decided not to. But now I'll say it on this interview. At WWE Tough Enough, Bill DeMott was the man who led the trainings, made sure that those trainings were exactly what they were, but made sure that WWE Tough Enough name lived up to it. He was trying to break you. I didn't see him doing anything more than what, in my mind, was one of those 80s tough-nosed trainers, like Mickey from Rocky Balboa.
Yep.
I never saw him do anything while I was at WWE Tough Enough. That was not just the hard-nosed Mickey training, hardcore training. I didn't see him kicking people or doing anything that was out of line. And granted, he would give us all crap for any sort of reason he could.
Yep.
And I hear about the homeless public slurs, but he would just give you crap. As you know, any wrestler gives, or any dude who has any sort of bromance or any sort of relationship with another dude, we don't say, hey, bud, how are you? We're not nice to each other. The closer you are with somebody, the meaner you are with somebody.
It's true.
And he had that same thing. I don't remember any specific terms or anything, but he was just one of those hard-nosed trainers that made you really, in your mind, decide, I really want this hard enough to keep pushing up. But I never saw anything at WWE Tough Enough that happened that took me off guard of like, hey, that was inappropriate.
And I think what you just said, that's why they put him there, is to get you guys ready to go for this because of how mentally trying that business has become. And I guess I've always wanted, I've never been able to meet Bill DeMott, but I always wanted to get that perspective, especially over the past 6 months of how everything has gone down of, you know, is this guy really the bully or the meanie, or is he just a guy that was hired to say, I need to go in here and make people tough enough legitimately because of what they're about to get themselves into?
And I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm not saying it did. I could definitely, with his hard-nosed style, believe that maybe there was times he would have in the WWE Performance Center, but I personally never saw it. It wouldn't surprise me, but I never saw it. He's always been that good hard-nosed trainer, but I never saw him go out of line when I was with him. Again, I've never been signed to a WWE developmental contract. I have been to the Performance Center at a WWE tryout.
How did that go for you?
I thought it was fantastic. It was very much like WWE Tough Enough, where he tried to break every single person that was there, mentally and physically, and he did. He broke several people in. There's a difference where in WWE Tough Enough, you go home if you quit. At the Performance Center, they were very okay with set your side, just catch breath, because there's people with zero athletic backgrounds to all sorts of crazy backgrounds. At that time, it was December 13, I think. But it was very much like WWE Tough Enough. He destroyed you. I didn't see anything while I was there. It's like, hey, that was maybe a little bit inappropriate. I didn't see that at all. It was a very hard-nosed tryout. And during the tryout, he even pulled aside, I think, like 10 people. He's like, I want you guys to look at these guys here. They're sweating. They're tired. But these are the guys right now that are leading the pack to get WWE contracts. And I was probably one of those 10 people. And so I'm like, sweet, my tryout's going great. Nothing came from it, which is perfectly fine because I'm happy where I'm at right now. We had Lucha Underground, so.
Well, and that is, I know that there's a span between the end of Tough Enough and where you're at now. Give me just a quick run through of some of the places that you worked out in the West Coast, and have you got a chance to travel throughout the world at all? Get over to Europe or Japan or anything like that?
I don't really want to go to Japan, especially when I'm doing a lot of trip work. I work with AAA right now. I get to Mexico. I was able to get down to Germany with Alex Wright. Remember him from WCW?
Yep. That's Wunderkind.
That's right. So, I got down to Germany last year for that. I was on mostly the West Coast. I was in Vegas, Colorado.
NWA Hollywood, correct?
Yep, NWA Hollywood. And I did a little bit of those shows. And really, my concentration was the WWE pulled me to heal up my leg, and then I talked to Stone Cold Steve Austin a couple times, because he's one of those guys that you could tell was there. And in my mind, some of the guys from the WWE Tough Enough trainers were there to collect a paycheck and be on WWE TV again.
Yep.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, the guy who's probably the most successful out of all of those guys, was there to make the business better. He was there to find somebody that was going to take this business up. In my mind, that's what he handed me. He gave me his personal cell phone and said, hey, call him again. And actually, he called me. I gave my number, and he called me and said, hey, how's your leg? Try to keep up with me. Ask him his thoughts on Tough Enough. And he was one of those guys that he was there. Like, I don't remember what the question was, but I'm just interested to see Austin.
Well, that's
make the business better.
Yeah, exactly. That's what the. So, are you going to be on the Broken Skull Ranch? Are you going to get down there in one of those competitions?
I thought about it.
That shit's crazy. That is just some of that stuff's outrageous. I've got a bad heart. There's no way I could make it through half of that stuff, but I enjoy the hell out of it, and it's so stone cold when you see it. I mean, it's just hot, fucking crazy, just competition to the finest.
And he says he loves that because it brings the mental toughness out of people that a lot of times you don't get to see when you go through work 9 to 5. It brings something mentally out of people that you no longer get to see. And he says he loves those shows. But his favorite show to do is WWE Tough Enough because he loves the wrestling business. That's his favorite show. And I even asked him straight up because you hear rumors. Oh, WWE Tough Enough was big. You hear rumors. The dirt sheet. I freaking love those dirt sheets. It wasn't. It was an actual competition. I sometimes when we ask questions like, hey, well, this guy did this, did that. Doesn't that make you angry? Like, you could see them trying to reach for any sort of straws that were already there in drama. But I was never saying, hey, you should say this because I really think you two would be good too. If you guys hate each other, that'd be great. Come on. No. It was competition. Stone Cold Steve Austin taped it. And then I called Stone Cold Steve Austin and asked him, so tell me, Duke Robinson versus Andrew Lyon. That's what you went with? That's what you went with him? I'm just saying, really? He's like, hey, well, my mind, I was vested, like, that was with the way WWE was at that time. It was, like, he was a man for it. And it was, honestly, you heard on the dirt sheets, like, oh, it was because he was big, or, like, some network called him, or something like that. Did they or didn't they? I don't know. But I asked you straight up, and you said that Andy was the man for Jim. I think Luke was.
Well, I've got a lot of stuff I want to talk to you about, Martin. We're at about an hour and a half right now.
Jesus, I'm sorry.
No, dude, it's been awesome. I wanna definitely talk with you again because we got to talk about Lucha Underground. But I think what you just said was a perfect spot for us to kind of wrap up this part of the conversation and build to another time when we can speak about Lucha Underground. We can speak about some of the current day product because you and I, you know, we watch, we love it. We watch WrestleMania and we've got a lot to talk about. We could probably sit here for another hour and a half and do that. But the Low Blow Booking Podcast, we want to look at an aspect of something. So here's my scenario for you. Over the years, we've had Tough Enough, and we've had these competitions, we've had the Diva searches, we've had these things where the WWE tries to introduce a new character into their company through these competitions, and in all reality, it has kind of failed to introduce the winner into the biggest stage for the long run. Would you agree with that?
Very much so.
So, we look at some of the winners. Maven was given the opportunity of a lifetime to fucking eliminate The Undertaker at the Rumble. And, you know, for one reason or another, Maven is now being a bouncer in New York or something like that. We look at Andy Levine, who won your season of Tough Enough, and dude gets popped, and now where the hell is he? With guys like Josh Matthews, John Morrison, and The Miz not winning the contest but still having successful careers, what would you do if there was a Tough Enough competition today? Or I guess even back when Andy won, because it was before NXT, it was before the Performance Center. What would you do to introduce a character from Tough Enough into the main roster of the WWE at that point in time? How do you think would be the best way for you to creatively put yourself on that big of a stage? Or do you think that they needed more time to work? What would you say to that?
Well, to go back to what you were saying about, you got John Morrison, who didn't win the first time, and then he won the second time. You got people who didn't win that made something out of it. They got these winners who won, and then nothing came out of it. I really think that is because of the people they choose in the case. That'd be a great season of TV. But these people, they see some of them have wrestled for a long time and legit want to make it in this business. But you got other people who just want some fame or just want some money out of it. Or, like, people who, okay, this business is fun, but it's a little bit too hard for me to do every single day. Like, I think what happens is you have those people who do Tough Enough and make the most of that, like John Morrison and Josh Matthews. You have those people that want to make something out of this business. They'll find a way to make something out of this business. But going back to how would you bring it back?
I meant, how would you bring a person from Tough Enough into the landscape of the WWE? I don't want to play, well, what if you didn't break your ankle? Would you have won? That kind of thing. But if you think about how do you bring a character from Tough Enough that year where it was given the ultimate stage, the ultimate audience, how would you bring a person from that into the current or that the product at that time?
Honestly, you just have to put over WWE Tough Enough more than they did. After WWE Tough Enough, how many times have you actually even heard the name WWE Tough Enough on WWE programming? I think they had Andy Devine show up one time in a backstage segment with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Like, that's it. But then you don't bring back the guy, Andy Devine, and don't put him on WWE TV ever again. So what you're doing is, yeah, we had this great competition, great TV, but we're not going to do anything with the winner. So the person that wins WWE Tough Enough, you can go maybe a couple months max. We because wrestling fans, they move through storylines fast. You can move a couple months max before this guy needs to be on TV. And preferably, this guy needs to be on TV now. Like, first off, if you're going to do anything, keep putting over WWE Tough Enough and setting up for Season 2 or Season 8 or whatever the heck season going on now of WWE Tough Enough. This needs to be, if you're going to put over any sort of character from WWE Tough Enough, it needs to be an ongoing thing. What you, in my mind, you should do, he's got the biggest name in the business in there, Stone Cold Steve Austin. You were seeing that the right idea was to put him in there with Andy. Let's give him the rug. But how do you do it? Really, it would probably...
Honestly...
you build him on at that time.
Yeah.
I really think that match between whoever... Like, I think they had, like, Andrew Levine, Bill DeMont, and Luke Robinson all had a match, and it was like, they went through the segments. Really, I think that when the winner of that match should wrestle Bill DeMont there on Raw.
Mm-hmm.
And it does something with Stone Cold Steve Austin involved to keep putting on WWE Tough Enough and saying, this guy is something. Give him a shot, or... I'm going there, everyone shits on WWE Tough Enough, and Stone Cold Steve Austin comes back out and wants the hell out of everybody, he tells everybody to drink beers.
Yep. I thought Al Snow did that with the first season. When he was actively wrestling, he was constantly trying to put over the product of Tough Enough. And I don't think that they gave it the legs after, you know, in during your season in the aftermath.
Yeah, I don't think they could put over the legs at all, but I think what was better... Because they had, well, back when the Miz did the like, $1 million challenge, they had, like, the Gladiator things, and they had all the stuff like Hannah and then Rocky Prince on SmackDown. So you're using SmackDown time to make these guys that no one cares about too much doing stupid stuff no one really wants to see. But people, like, we did some stupid stuff on WWE Tough Enough. Like,
some midgets playing basketball, man.
What the hell was that?
Yeah.
But, I thought it was ridiculous. Like, okay. But people cared about what you did in the ring, those complications that we did in the ring. So make that something that happens on WWE Tough Enough, and then you have an actual match happen on Raw. Let's not mix the guys, just like NXT, where they do game show crap. That was horrid.
Yep.
do something with WWE Tough Enough where he has a match, and hey, he goes over on a couple guys. And then, in my mind, keep putting over the fact that WWE Tough Enough and keep mentioning it, that he did this, and this, now he's, like, he maybe even make a successful success story. Maybe he's the big underdog now. That he gets into WWE Tough Enough, now he gets surprised by the people on the big stage, but at the very end, can't kill the character because he's got to go over on the big end, and he just loses the big match at the end, and, all right, well, WWE's up to Tough Enough is nothing again. I really agree with you. Is WWE Tough Enough needed to be talked about, mentioned, anything after the show to continue to make a season two and thereafter seasons? You got the biggest name in the business, and I think there's all sorts of ways you could do it, because you got Bill DeMont there, who people always saw as now he's a hard-ass trainer, so that's a great story to put across. Let's let me and Bill have a match. Let us go and actually have a regular match and not just show highlights of it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's tell each other. Then you have Stone Cold Steve Austin, or even make like you have the Miz. Let's put the Miz over here and said he has surpassed WWE Tough Enough. Let's let me and him go at it for a little bit. And then at the very end, we have a match. And Stone Cold Steve Austin kind of gets involved or something. Where Tough Enough comes out on top.
Yep. And I believe the key element is let's use what the people know, Bill DeMott, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Miz, to introduce something that they don't know, our Tough Enough winner, and put them over people that they see regularly. Now, there's plenty of guys who are not classified as jobbers in the WWE, but there are plenty of guys who know how to do a job and put somebody over. And I think that's what you need to do with this product is say, this is how it works. Now, if the rumors are true and Tough Enough is coming back, it looks like it's going to be a Performance Center thing. It looks like it's going to be an NXT thing. And that may just be the right avenue for it to go. because like we talked about, you need to talk about it. You need to put it in people's faces. And with the network, now they can do anything they want. But I think that's the main thing. Give people what they know to introduce them to something that you want them to know by using people that they, you know, can believably beat. And in the end, you hopefully get a star out of the entire process. And Morrison, I thought, was really good for a long time. Josh Matthews, you know, he's a very a good talent for the WWE and now for TNA. And then The Miz, you know, just, you know, took what many would see as annoyance and turned it into a WWE champion that beat John Cena at WrestleMania. You got to give people time, and we live in a fast-paced world where things need to change every second, and there's got to be some time. We got to let things grow, and I think that's what the name of the game is with Tough Enough, is letting the product grow and not – it's kind of like the XFL. People said the XFL would have worked if it was 3 years – if it was a three-year product, and then after that they do it, but instead they did it for 1 year, and now it's a laughingstock.
Yep,
but
I agree.
But watch the NFL today, and there's still things that the NFL took from the XFL that they pioneered, and you never know what history would have been had they given it more legs and done more things with it. And you know, we can always play the guessing game, but you know, I don't think that we've seen the end of Martin Casals. It sounds like things with Lucha Underground are starting to pick up, and I think that's where we're going to kind of wrap up our show today, is to give people a teaser into the next opportunity that you and I get to talk and describe to me what Lucha Underground is for people that haven't seen it. Talk about anything that you've also been doing on the side. I know you're a big comic book guy, big superhero guy. Talk about some of that stuff and, you know, go from there and see what the current product looks like and where we can take things and sit down for another hour and 40 minutes and shoot the shit. How's that sound?
That sounds fantastic, and I 100% agree with, and I couldn't have said it better with WWE. You wrap it up perfectly. Use what they know to put something they don't know and put it over as much as they can using what they know. You said it perfectly right there. And I think the problem with doing a podcast with two people who've wrestled before, and we talk about stuff like Tough Enough and, hey, how did your character hurt and how did it get? I want to talk about it because it's something that was important to me. And you and me, being wrestlers, we want to talk about wrestling all day. So it makes a podcast a really long story.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to our feedback. You know, everybody was interested in seeing what we were going to talk about, and I think that we delivered tonight. Again, check us out on the Low Blow Booking Podcast. We're going to come back. Me and Martin are going to chat another time and see what his career with Lucha Underground's doing. Myself and Dave Hall, the Thunder from Down Under, him and I are going to be coming back with some great stuff in the coming weeks. We're definitely going to be looking at the Bret Hart situation in 97 and what would it look like if he had stayed around. You know, some other fun projects in the mix. We also really want to look at the Muhammad Hassan angle and how that could have been handled better. And even the Ultimate Warrior's WWE title run in 1990. So a lot of fun stuff on the Low Blow Booking Podcast. Give us a share. Give us a like. Let the people know about it. Martin, it has been an awesome experience talking to you tonight. I appreciate everything you've done, your honesty, and I look forward to speaking with you again in the future, man.
I look forward to it. I appreciate it very much. For those of you on the honor, I just want to go throw and draw my bet. Follow me, please. Without you fans, if there is no wrestling, follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, /MartinCasals. It's literally just my name. Write me. I'll write you back. Keep in touch with these guys because I want to come back and tell us more stories. Keep in touch. I'll be on your TV very soon.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Martin. You have a great night. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to end things now with the theme of the half-breed heartthrob, Martin Casals. Thank you very much. They want to hold you back, tell them they off. Whenever they say you can't, take the day off. I remember when they told me I wouldn't be famous. Now my dream and reality is simultaneous. I've worked your own way to the top. If they put you on the pedestal, they can take you off. And there's a higher level than the top. You gotta make more, don't make do with what you got. Yeah, so go and get it in, sonny. Not everybody...